remove sanctions against the country. Israelis hold a mass rally for a 32nd week in a row to protest the judicial reform plan proposed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right cabinet. And trade tensions escalate between the U.S. and China as both sides accuse the other of violating trade regulations. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's foreign minister says that the Islamic Republic has never left the negotiating table and that Tehran will continue efforts for the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is focused on dynamic diplomacy to fulfill national interests since taking office in August of 2021. Remarks came after Iran's foreign ministry confirmed ongoing process of releasing $6 billion worth of Iranian funds, which have been unlawfully held in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. It added a number of Iranians who've been detained in the U.S. on baseless accusations will also be released soon. On Saturday, Iran's central bank chief said that all of Iran's frozen funds in South Korea have been unblocked and that it will be used for non-sanctioned goods.
The Iranian foreign ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life.
The process of releasing Iran's assets in South Korea comes after Iranian funds blocked in Iraq were frozen, or unfrozen, that is, last month. All those have been seen as victories for the administration of President Raisi, who's been pursuing what they've called a dignified diplomacy.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy. Policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
Political commentator Isha Krishnaswamy says the Israeli lobby in the U.S. is currently pushing hard for anti-Iran sanctions to remain in place, and this complicates sanctions removal talks.
We know in the West there is a big lobbying effort from both Israel and Saudi Arabia that kind of fights against Iranians' interest. And unfortunately, a lot of this lobbying efforts have been successful in poisoning the well against Iran. And of course, most media outlets do not explain both the economic power and how some companies have an umbrella beyond the sanctions in order to protect themselves from getting in trouble with the U.S. So medical equipment is an excellent example where even in situations where it's legal, many companies will not export to Iran because they want to have a safe harbor. So, yeah. So, unfortunately, as long as these interests in Washington continue, they will be pushing hard for continuing sanctions, and the situation is unlikely to change.
Tens of thousands of Israelis have thronged Tel Aviv for a 32nd consecutive week, protesting against a hard-right cabinet's judicial overhaul, which will see the highest court stripped of most of its powers. People carried a massive banner with pictures of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other ministers, with that caption reading, Israel's coup criminals. More than 150 other demonstrations were slated to take place in other towns and cities, as well as outside homes of Israeli officials. Organizers said the judicial coup has led to racist policies, the collapse of the police, and the beginning of a wave of immigration. Despite the massive backlash, though, Netanyahu says he'll move ahead with the changes. The planned judicial overhaul, which was proposed in January, sparked massive protests and criticism at home and abroad. Israel's main ally, the U.S., has also criticized the move. Saudi Arabia is a named non-resident ambassador for the occupied Palestinian territories, who will also serve as consul general in Al-Quds. The announcement marks the first time that the kingdom will have official diplomatic representation in Palestine. Role will be filled by current Saudi ambassador to Jordan, who traditionally handles a Palestine file for Riyadh. Saudi Arabia said move is an important step which underscores the desire to boost ties with the state of Palestine. Announcement comes amid reports Riyadh and Washington have held talks on Saudi conditions of normalization with Israel. Chronic financial crisis of the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is deeply worsening, especially in the second half of this year. This has created concerns among Palestinian refugees that the UN agency could end all of its services, as soon as this September, our Gaza correspondent Ola Alassi reports.
75 years after the forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries.
UNRWA's financial crisis started since signings of the Oslo Accord. It is mainly a political crisis, not financial, aroused by the U.S. administrations and the EU. The crisis is worsening every year, especially in Gaza. The donor countries have defunded and stopped their aids.
Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services.
After my father's passing, I continue to live with the same suffering. The UNRWA's food supplies are not sufficient anymore. I beg my neighbors to feed us because I can't support my family. I can't work due to the health issues. My wife is also ill, and the UNRWA's medical centers, which are responsible for providing health care to us, don't provide her with the medications needed.
Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatem is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.
The politicization of the Palestinian refugees' plight jeopardizes the lives of over 1.2 million people in the Gaza Strip. The international community must shoulder their responsibilities towards the Palestinian refugees who were forcibly displaced from their original lands. Palestinian refugees continue to suffer since they were displaced back during the Nakba in 1948 by the Israeli occupation. The current onerous financial crisis is harming thousands of Palestinian refugee families in Gaza whose only hope is not to go hungry. Al-Asi, Gaza.
White House says the U.S. President Joe Biden's comment about China being a ticking time bomb refers to its internal economic and social tensions. Spokesperson John Kirby said that these tensions can have an effect on how Beijing interacts with the world. He said one area of U.S. concern regarding China is the way Beijing bullies and coerces and intimidates countries around the world by offering high-interest infrastructure loans and then seizes assets when countries default. On Thursday, Biden said at a political fundraiser, China is in trouble and beset with economic and social problems. Comments have drawn sharp response from Beijing. Chinese embassy spokesperson Li Pengyu warned Washington against scapegoating Beijing and fanning division and confrontation. China's Ministry of Commerce also accused Washington of frequently breaching World Trade Organization rules and damaging the shared interests of its members. West Africa's regional bloc ECOWAS says it aims to send a parliamentary committee to Niger to meet coup leaders who took power last month. The committee seeks to get the permission of the Nigerian president who holds ECOWAS chairmanship for the overture. The Nigerian religious leaders have already met with coup leaders in Niamey. According to media reports, they explained to junta leaders that Nigeria is not fighting Niger and any decisions taken on Niger are not Nigeria's but those of ECOWAS. Niger's military last month imprisoned President Mohamed Bazoum. Takeover drew condemnation from ECOWAS, which has even threatened military action against Niger if coup leaders do not release and reinstate the president. At least six Afghan men have drowned after their boat capsized trying to cross the English Channel from France to get to the UK. Human rights groups blame what they're calling Britain's border repression for this tragedy. Officials say two people may still be missing and around 60 have been rescued. Vessel got into trouble in the sea near Calais in the early hours of Saturday. Most people on board were from Afghanistan. Channel between France and the UK is one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, and strong currents are common. Human rights groups have criticized the UK's crackdown on asylum seekers, saying the difficulty of securing legal passage only pushes people to take more and more risks to reach England. Figures say number of people taking the world's deadliest migratory route to reach Europe has more than doubled this year. Our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, says as far as European officials, particularly those of Britain, continue their unworkable refugee policies, the more tragic as accidents like this are going to happen.
What was particularly galling, I think, for a lot of humanitarian pro-refugee groups was Home Secretary Suella Braverman doing a thoughts and prayers to those affected tweets after hearing the news. I mean, let's be honest, a woman who has single-handedly spearheaded one of the most hostile refugee and immigration policies. If, like a lot of the charities, including Refugee Council, including Freedom from Torture, Care for Calais, and other organizations have pointed out correctly, had our legal processes been in place to ensure that those who are looking to gain asylum or refugee status in the United Kingdom are able to do so in a legal way, with a path that does not include a lot of these people smugglers and very dangerous vessels, we would not have had the loss of lives like we have now. Remember, you know, in a lot of the gutter press, there will almost be a celebratory mood because they are hoping stories like this will deter people from trying to cross the channel, crossing the Mediterranean to make their way to a better situation for themselves and their families. That is not the case. You're simply going to have more individuals willing to risk their very lives to do this. And unless the government, both here and on mainland Europe, can actually get their act together and get a humane policy in place, instead of a lot of these gimmicks like the Bibi Stockholm, that floating quasi-prison to house refugees, unworkable refugee laws and so on, we're going to have more of these tragedies.
Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A group of 94 French lawmakers have written to President Emmanuel Macron expressing their dissatisfaction with France's African policy failures, which they argue have resulted in deteriorating relations among former colonies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, French senators have claimed in a letter published in the French newspaper Le Figaro that the rise in anti-French sentiment on the African continent was the result of Paris failing to successfully cooperate with countries on military, political, and cultural fronts. Relations between Paris and its former African colonies have faltered in recent years, with the country increasingly becoming unpopular throughout the Sahel region, where its military is deployed to fight against militants. France ended a counterinsurgency mission, Operation Barkhane, late last year, and withdrew its military from Mali after nearly a decade due to a breakdown in relations following Bamako's May 2021 coup. In December last year, Paris also withdrew troops from the Central African Republic, citing an alleged closer relationship between the African country and Russia. Protests against the European country have grown in recent years, sparked by perceived military shortcomings and allegations of interference in the internal affairs of former colonies. Niger, the last remaining ally of Paris in the Sahel region, underwent a coup on July 26, prompting the new military government to cancel defense agreements with the former colonizing power amid a wave of anti-French sentiment. In the letter, French politicians stated that the failure of Operation Barkhane had exposed not only the country's military to rejection in the Sahel, but also French businesses, as countries continue to mobilize citizens against the old colonial power. They said, "This movement in sub-Saharan Africa is spreading with demonstrations and anti-French acts even in countries known to be close to us, such as Côte d'Ivoire or Senegal." France's Frank-Frick policy, they claim, has been replaced by military Russia-Frick, economic China-Africa, or diplomatic America. The authors added, in Tunisia, the erratic president Kais Saied turns alternately to the United States, the European Union, or the Arab world, and less to France, which no longer has a privileged role. The legislators urged Macron to re-evaluate the French government's policies in Africa, which they described as a friendly continent, in order to correct misunderstandings about its role and presence. Al Jazeera English also noted France's influence in West Africa is weakening despite President Emmanuel Macron's efforts. Niger has seen rising anti-French sentiment since its military deposed the president and took power. In recent months, several countries in West Africa have moved to end their military ties with France, demanding French troops leave the region. The former colonial power appears to be losing its influence in the Sahel region. That's despite President Emmanuel Macron's election promise to reset ties with the continent. Press TD had earlier reported that hundreds of people in Niger took to the streets to show their support for the military coup that has removed President Mohamed Bazoum from power and triggered anti-French sentiments across the region. A number of demonstrators recently in Niamey held a placard that said, "Long live Niger, Russia, Mali, and Burkina. Down with France, ECOWAS, and the EU." Many of them chanted anti-Western slogans and waved Russian flags as they gathered outside the National Assembly. The angry protesters also denounced the main regional bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, which has imposed sanctions on Niger and said it could authorize the use of force if soldiers did not restore Bazoum to power. A protester at the rally was quoted as saying, "We are going to demonstrate to all the ECOWAS countries and all those who are taking inhumane and unpopular measures against Niger." General Abdourahamane Tchiani, the former head of Niger's presidential guard, confined Bazoum to his residence and declared himself head of state in the seventh coup in the West and Central Africa since 2020. In his address recently, Tchiani called the sanctions inhumane, saying he rejected any foreign interference but was open to dialogue within the country. Tchiani has won the backing of the juntas in some neighboring countries and cited persistent insecurity as his main justification for seizing power. According to Press TV, Mali and Burkina Faso have said they would treat an intervention in Niger as a declaration of war against them too and would come to Niamey's defense. Tchiani sent a general to both countries to shore up support. The rally comes amid a growing wave of anti-French sentiment, with locals saying they want the former colonial ruler to stop interfering in their affairs. Junta supporters also say they want French troops to leave Niger. Observers say resentment towards France seems to be coming to a boiling point in Mali, Burkina Faso, and now Niger. France has a long history in West Africa where it was a colonial power until 1960. Since independence, France has maintained a military presence in the region, which has caused long-term tensions that now seem to be reaching new heights. French troops withdrew from Mali in 2022 and Burkina Faso in 2023 following military coups. New leadership in Niger would lead to another withdrawal from a country France saw as a key ally in the Sahel. France has between 1,000 and 1,500 troops in Niger to fight the so-called war on terrorism. In Niger, there are not only French forces, but American and European troops as well. Burkina Faso and Mali have already kicked out French troops, many of whom are now stationed in Niger. Meanwhile, the turmoil has prompted some European nations to evacuate citizens by plane. Paris said recently it has completed the evacuation of hundreds of French and European citizens.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our condolences to you all on the martyrdom anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him. Let us now ponder on a wise statement from him. One who is content with whatever God has destined for him is the most wealthy and needless person.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of our family when it comes to charity and generosity when living an Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor, dear friends, to be at your service. So we're talking about the position and the status of our family members when it comes to charity and generosity. Now, sometimes people have a tendency to not really know who to be generous with or who to give charity to. Now, unfortunately, we have this conception and this idea in our minds that the people who deserve our generosity and our charity the most are individuals who are far removed from us, meaning there are individuals who we don't know. They are individuals who you have to kind of find because they're hiding, you know, or there are individuals who we have no relation with. Now, this tends to cause certain problems because in a very beautiful Islamic economic and financial system and in an Islamic lifestyle, we find that every individual is responsible financially, spiritually, morally, ethically, and in our discussion, charitably, with those people that are in their immediate circle. And if everybody were to take care of the people in these different aspects in their immediate circle, then all of these circles together create a society. And matter of fact, in this manner, you probably wouldn't have individuals who are poor or are needy, because everybody is taking care of their own. It is when we forget to take care of our own on a, you know, familial and family level that on a societal level we end up turning into problems. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about charity and generosity and how we need to primarily focus on our family members. Now, we kind of started to talk a little bit about it in the previous segment, but we're going to try to close it off in this segment of Islamic lifestyle. Now, what we are talking about, of course, is that if every individual were to take care of their immediate family members, so, you know, we're talking about like your spouse, your children, your parents, your siblings, right? These individuals that are your close-knit family members, they are your nuclear family members, if you will. We're not talking about relatives or cousins or friends or these kind of individuals. Those family members that are very close to us. Many a time, it is these individuals who are in need. They need your charity, they need your generosity, and they need your help. But for some reason, we end up overlooking these very individuals. Now, we're not saying that, you know, your spouse or your children or your parents, they are financially well off and you should still give them charity and you should still be generous. That doesn't make any sense. That does not go along with the definition of charity or generosity. But what is an unfortunate condition and situation is that there are times when these same individuals, our spouses or our children or our parents or our siblings, are in need, yet we don't help them. Now, when we don't help those people in our immediate circle, we really can't help and expect other people in their other circles to come out of their circle and help ours. And so if everybody helps their own circle, these circles will create a society which is strong and independent and definitely will be able to better live an Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Carpets. Part 1. In the Safavid era, carpets gained a distinguished status and valuable carpets were woven. After the Safavid era, the quality of Iranian carpets gradually decreased. Sometimes it flourished and sometimes declined. In this episode, we'll review the history of Iranian carpets after the end of the Safavid era until the present day. This is Khorshid Palace in Kalat city of Khorasan, Razavi province, a monument that remains from Nader Shah Afshar's era. After the fall of Isfahan by the Afghans and the murder of Shah Sultan Hussein Safavi, the situation in Iran was chaotic for a long time, until a general from the Afshar tribe named Nader defeated the Afghans in several battles and started a war against the Europeans and the Ottoman Empire. Although Nader managed to return Bahrain, Kandahar, and Khwarazm and Bukhara to the territory of Iran, he did not pay any attention to the evolution of art, particularly carpet weaving. During this era and the chaos after his death, no valuable carpet were woven. However, the tradition was followed by nomads and the artists of this industry in small towns. It is difficult to recognize the carpets left from the Afsharid era, because this era was not so long. So the design and pattern of carpets didn't undergo fundamental changes, so the carpets of this era can't be recognized through that. However, written documents show that carpet weaving flourished in some regions of Iran. According to a report by the East India Company, the EIC, beautiful silk and woolen carpets were abundant in the Bandar Abbas market in 1738. In the middle of the 17th century CE, Portuguese explorer Pedro Teixeira has also spoken about carpet weaving in Yazd and has singled out carpets among the most distinguished carpets in Iran. Thank you. Mohammed Kazim Marvi, the minister of Marv and the author of the histography of Alam Aray Nadari, has also talked about Nadir Shah's order to the province of Kerman to send rugs, felt carpets, and other high-quality goods to Yerevan's church. All these written documents indicate that carpet weaving was not abandoned in the Afsharid era, but it did not have a chance to progress amid the chaos of those days. This is Karim Khan Citadel in the center of Shiraz, which was built during the reign of Karim Khan Zand. After Karim Khan chose Shiraz as the capital and this place as his residence, it became known as Karim Khan Citadel. After Karim Khan Zand ascended the throne, the country experienced a relative calm. The calm that prepared the ground for the progress of the carpet industry. The globetrotters who were in Iran during the era of Karim Khan and his successors have mentioned the carpets of our country in their writings. Karsten Niebuhr, a Dutch explorer who was in Shiraz in 1765, wrote that Turkmen, women, and Turkish-speaking Fars nomad weave carpets that are exported in large quantities. It's a wonder that in spite of lack of facilities and equipment, they dye wool very well and weave good carpets. This palace, known as Aga Mohammed Khan Qajar Palace, dates back to the early Qajar era and is actually considered the first palace of this era. At the end of the Zand era, Aga Mohammed Khan Qajar took advantage of the internal crisis after the death of Karim Khan Zand, and after disposing Loft Ali Khan Zand, he was crowned as the King of Iran. This is how the Qajar era began. Like the Afsharids and the Zands, the Qajars were not able to set up large royal workshops and boost the art of Iranian carpet weaving to reach the fame of the Safavid era through supporting well-known carpet weavers and designers. However, the Qajar kings used to order magnificent carpets for their palaces or holy sites. That's why exquisite carpets remained from that era. In this relatively long period, artists created new works based on the precious heritage left from the history of Iranian art, particularly the Safavid era. This carpet with an inscription belonged to the era of Fath Ali Shah. It is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The weaving of this carpet with inscriptions took 4 years in Kanamoy workshop of Tabriz and was completed in 1808. The pattern and the design of the carpet is completely creative. In the carpet design, the Shahnameh scenes are pictured in 25 frames, in the style of miniature paintings, and in the spaces between the frames, poems describing each scene are written. Another antique carpet of the Qajar era dates back to the reign of Muhammad Khan Qajar as the Crown Prince. This carpet was woven in the year 1832 by the order of Crown Prince Muhammad Mirza. The pile and warp of this carpet is made of silk, and its creative design and color have made it special. This carpet was woven in Heris, one of the cities of East Azerbaijan province, and it's kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. To mention one of the beautiful carpets of the Qajar era, we need to refer to the large carpet in the mirror hall of the Golestan Palace. This carpet was woven in Moshkabad, Herat city, and is kept in the treasury of Golestan National Palace. It is interesting that in the painting of the mirror hall of Kamal ul-Mulk, the famous painter of the Qajar era, the carpet is carefully depicted. We go to Kerman from the Golestan Palace's mirror hall. One of the active cities in carpet weaving in the Qajar era. This carpet, with a design known as Meliat, nationalities, is an exquisite carpet woven in Kerman. In the main field of the rug, there's a tree with three main branches, and on its branches are fruits such as apples, pears, pomegranates, and grapes, and different kinds of birds including parrots, swallows, sparrows, crows, owls, peacocks, and different kinds of animals, including ostriches, turkeys, ducks, drakes, and even water animals can be seen in a lake in the background at the bottom edge of the carpet. On the main border of the carpet, there are 10 circular frames with images of 10 different nationalities wearing traditional clothes. This carpet has an inscription at the bottom edge of the main field, which shows that it was woven in 1898 by Master Abul Qasim Kermani, and the designer was Forsat ad-Dowleh Shirazi, the famous designer in Kerman. In the margin of this carpet, there are images of people from different nationalities with animal species of the same regions. This carpet is made of wool and yarn, and is known by the names of Forsat Shirazi and Meliat. It is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The Cypress Peacock Carpet is another carpet from the Qajar era, and this one is also woven in the city of Kerman. If we pay attention to the design of this carpet, we can see the cypress and the vase in the center of the carpet, which is surrounded by a frame with a prayer niche design. There are two peacocks next to the cypress vase as guardian and sacred birds. Many flowers can be seen on the border and in the inner field of the carpet, which are a symbol of the Garden of Paradise. There are paisley patterns in the border and the cypress's inner design. Paisley is the shape of a bent cypress tree, and is itself a symbol of the cypress tree. The two other peacocks can be seen on top of the cypress tree. The warp and weft of this carpet is made of cotton, and the pile is made of wool. In the upper part of the carpet, the names of the carpet weavers can be seen. This carpet is also kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The mentioned carpets were some of the famous carpets of the Qajar era, but a relatively large group of carpets from the Qajar era are pictorial carpets, a significant number of which are kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. Pictorial carpets in the Qajar era included images of kings and notables, ancient motifs, and special design. One of the carpets in the Carpet Museum of Iran shows the image of Hushang Shah in his old age and with a white beard sitting on a throne, like a royal throne. This is while two devils are carrying the throne. This design is inspired by the story of Hushang Shah's battle with the demons and their subjugation by Hushang in Shahnameh. In the margin of the carpet, there are animal motifs such as camels and cows, which are noticeable due to the balanced coloring. The pictorial carpet of Hushang Shah was woven in Kerman and is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. Mashaher, Luminaire's carpet, is another beautiful pictorial carpet in the Qajar era, which has been designed with 109 Iranian kings, 54 world's famous people, and 16 images of Sassanid and Achaemenid era rock reliefs. This carpet was designed in 1920 by Hassan Khan Shakuri and woven by Master Ali Kermani. The border of this carpet is adapted from the book Ajam, authored by Forsad Od Dole Shirazi. In the lower part of the inner field of the carpet, there's a picture of Ahmad Shah Qajar, and in the middle field, which is oval, some notables are designed. In the middle of the carpet, the royal throne is less visible and is mostly designed and covered with plant motifs. This carpet is kept in the Niavaran Palace Complex. Among other exquisite pictorial carpets of the Qajar era is this carpet, which is called the Astrolabe or Mintaka al-Buruj carpet. Astrolabe carpet is one of the most beautiful carpets of Isfahan, which has a very rare design. The design of the carpet is medallion corner, and the central medallion is circular. Symbols and names of different months and years are woven on the circle in Persian, Turkish, and Arabic. The symbols are taken from the old Christian calendar. And the lower head medallion represents the moon, and in the four edges of the rug, there are four symbols of the four planets of the solar system, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, and Mars.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the annals of Palestinian resistance, there are many important landmarks, but Jenin would find its place near the top. This small refugee camp in the northern West Bank has endured more than its share of Zionist barbarism, but the brave youth have not succumbed. Called the Jenin Brigades, they have proved more than a match for the heavily armed Zionist thugs. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "For 48 hours, on July 3rd and 4th, Israeli regime occupation army threw its military might at the residents of Jenin refugee camp that is spread over less than half a square kilometer's space. The densely packed camp, comprising houses and alleyways, is home to some 23,600 people. All of them are Palestinians, either ethnically cleansed from their villages by Zionist terrorist gangs in 1947 to 1948, or are descendants of the displaced Palestinians. During last month's Zionist attack, some 3,000 Palestinians were also forced to flee again from the refugee camp of Jenin. More than 1,000 heavily armed Israeli regime troops invaded the camp. They brought attack dogs to terrorize the Palestinians. Armored personnel carriers and hundreds of bulldozers were also deployed, plowing their way through the camp, resulting in the destruction or damage to more than 80% of houses. Drones and helicopter gunships were also used in the assault. Imagine 23,000 people crammed in a tiny enclave being bombarded from the air. Through its lying nature, the Zionist regime claimed it sent in the army to kill or capture, as they claimed, terrorists. After 2 days of attacks, 12 Palestinians were killed, among them 4 children. At least 130 Palestinians were injured. The Zionists prevented ambulances from picking up the injured. They also attacked hospitals to prevent them from providing medical aid to the victims. Did the Israeli regime army really kill or capture any terrorists? What is a terrorist anyway? People under occupation have the right, under international law, to resist their occupiers by any means necessary. This is what the Palestinians are doing to confront the Zionist invaders. So, the designation of Palestinians as terrorists is utterly false. It is the Zionists who are the real terrorists. They are the ones terrorizing the Palestinians even in the refugee camps in their own homeland. Residents of the camp also refuted Zionist claims. They said it was civilians, not armed fighters, who bore the brunt of the Israeli regime assault. The question, however, is why does Israel even bother to tell lies? After all, the Western supporters, financiers, and backers have always backed them, regardless of the crimes they commit. Whatever crimes the Zionist regime commits, and it has a long, gory record of horrific crimes killing children, women, and the elderly,